Thank you very much. Tess is going to sit by the computer because I'm going, as long as it works for me, I'm going to show two short clips during the lecture, which are made by a filmmaker called Amy Hardy, who is artist in residence at Strathcallan Hospice in Scotland. And if you wanted to know a bit more about films, I can tell you later on. I've been invited to reflect on actual Christian practice today rather than on what should be believed, so I don't take any responsibility for the practices that I describe in the lecture. Christian practices of man dying vary across the world, of course, and across denominations, and even within a single congregation. So I can't at all convey the whole range. And I'm conscious also that I don't discuss people such as Chinese background Christians or others who have more than one culture strongly influencing their practices around dying. I speak broadly about the West, where the culture is simultaneously secularised and multi-faith, in which healthcare governs most dying, and in which the term spirituality has more currency often than faith. Society has banished death, says Philippe Hallier's, of contemporary Western attitudes. The disappearance of an individual no longer affects its continuity. Everything in town goes on as if nobody died anymore. And he talks about the old black hearse being replaced by a grey limousine and blending in with the flow of the traffic. We don't like to mark death, but it's not that we wholly avert our eyes from it. We're intellectually and artistically fascinated by death, producing university courses and conferences and cultural festivals on the theme. We follow anxiously the shifting thought on causes of mortality, and thereby learn that dying is something we should not do. Sometimes we are public in our mourning, creating shrines of flowers, for example, where a young person has died. This might be a post-Princess Diana thing. We're more conversant about death than our grandparents and parents, and less inclined to shroud it for children. And we become specialists in bereavement, developing bereavement support tailored, for example, to children, parents, lesbian and gay people, teachers and others in professional roles. We have a popular phrase, in denial, which derives from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's famous model of the stages of dying and grieving, and we apply her cycle of emotions to all kinds of change and loss. Yet we do find it hard to acknowledge death as an ending, and we hanker after continuity, and so we can indeed behave as though nobody died anymore. Henry Scott Holland's words, "Death is nothing at all, I have only slipped away into the next room," are amongst the most popular at funerals today. I'll say a bit more about those words shortly. Sometimes we do not even hold funerals. The deceased has asked not to have one. In Scotland, a practice is developing whereby families hold a private commitment to crematorium first and follow it not with a funeral, but with a memorial or thanksgiving. Undertakers encourage this because it makes practical arrangements straightforward, but they wouldn't encourage it if clients found it insensitive. Mourners opt for short and private committals, which move them quickly on from the finality of death and back to a focus on life. And this affects the nature of church provision for them and for the deceased. Funerals help us to receive the dead, send them on their way, and then take our leave, for we have to begin the task of adjusting to life without them. Memorials and thanksgiving keep the dead alive, which becomes confused if we have not seen the coffin and been faced with the truth that they have indeed died. In the US, the desire for continuity gives rise to other trends, an increased belief in heaven despite a decrease in most other religious beliefs, and therefore, presumably, a heaven that floats free from the trauma and trials of getting there, and a growing belief in the rapture amongst evangelical Christians, which is the hope that Christians who are alive today will not die, but will be caught up in the clouds when Jesus returns. These trends reflect and affect how we are around death. If we do not face death, then death asserts its rule over us, and we become still less able to face it. In a famous sermon preached in 1907, Albert Schweitzer provokes us to overcome death by becoming familiar with it. He tells us to regard our lives and those who are part of our lives as though we have already lost them in death, only to receive them back for a little while. He encourages us with insights into the benefits that follow. True inward freedom from material things, feeling purified and delivered from our baser selves, a deepened appreciation of the preciousness of life and of our loved ones, so that we can become sacred to the other because of death. I'm just going to show you a short clip of a woman called Karen, who's living with secondary cancer and has gone through all the fear of this, the dreadful fear of getting that secondary diagnosis, and then comes through the other side.
But I didn't change who I loved and what things meant to me. Just things meant a lot more to me. Much more precious. The day to wake up and think I'm feeling good to be here. I'm not time for folk get stressed out now and running about daft and grumpy and no time for people and busy. Look, just look what's around you. And if you just had a diagnosis of secondary cancer, just please don't give up hope.
Now, if we're not in a situation like Karen's, where we've really faced our own death and know that it's imminent, how can we get the kind of perspective that she has come to gain, where she's so much more aware of the preciousness of life and of her loved ones? Well, Shrine 2 calls us as Christians to our baptism, because in our baptism, we have already died, and we now live in the world, he says, as ones who are inwardly freed from the world by death. And in context, Henry Scott Holland's message, which was preached 3 years later in 1910, is remarkably similar. Scott Holland acknowledges death's reign over us. Indeed, he calls it the king of terrors, cruel, irrational, and pit of destruction. And yet, he says, death is nothing at all, because by our baptism, it is now behind us and not in front. So let the dead things go and lay hold on life, Scott Holland exhorts us. Then the old will drop away from you and the new wonder will begin. You will find yourself already passed from death to life. Shrikes from Scott Holland do not teach that we can have ongoing life without passing through death, which is the wishful thinking of our own time. But they do suggest that by practicing our passage through death, we can already experience some of the life that death can yield and become prepared for the losses that our physical death will bring. So they articulate the art of dying. The art of dying teaches detachment from the world. In the centuries following the Reformation, people were instructed to learn this art whilst they were still in good health and not leave it to the hour of their death. But since the 19th century, we have increasingly medicalised the concept of dying well and have confined it again to a person's last illness and perhaps even to their very final moments. Today, there's little awareness that dying was ever considered an art to be learned throughout life. But dying and receiving life are central motifs of Christian worship and discipleship, and something of this pattern rubs off on us. In baptism, we die on the night of Christ, put off the old and take on the new. We're taught to take up our cross daily. At the Eucharist, we remember the passion and death of Christ and partake of his body so that we are made into his body, our life established by his death. Regular daily prayers, though we may not be regular in saying them, treat every sleep as a dying and every morning as a rising. At evening and night prayer, we pray that God will let us depart in peace and we commend our spirit into God's hands. Our major annual observances also lead us to reflect upon mortality and life-giving death, particularly Lent, Holy Week and Easter, when we remember Christ's passion, death and resurrection. But also All Saints, All Souls, Remembrance Sunday and Saints Days, when we remember those who have died before us. Moreover, Christianity casts most spiritual practice as a kind of dying. We die to pride when we ask for forgiveness, to grievances when we forgive others, to security when we take risks, to fear when we love, to possessiveness when we let people go, and so on. And all of these mini-deaths are echoes of our baptism. If we continually die in Christian discipleship, we approach our physical deaths as people who are continually being transformed. This is why we ask God to grant us to die daily to sin, that we may evermore live with Christ in the joy of his risen life. And this is why we might say at home before a funeral, "We shall not die, but we shall be changed. The perishable shall be clothed with the imperishable, and the mortal must be clothed with immortality." So even if our death is not good physically, we hope that it will be the passage to our final transformation. However, the process of clothing our mortal bodies with immortality is not seamless. We fear the known on this side of death, whatever hope we might attach to the hereafter, and we may not find a strong connection between spiritually and physically dying, so as to feel prepared for the latter. Furthermore, Christian worship and teaching are themselves affected by contemporary silences around death. For example, ministers may take several funerals a week and yet not bring their reflections on death into their regular Sunday services. I've been struck by how theologians and clergy disregard the metaphor of dying in our spiritual discipline and prefer other terms such as letting go or unselfing. But these gentle terms don't convey the radical way in which our spiritual disciplines can send us back to nothing. We die, and out of that we rise. As a Lutheran minister put it to me, we don't just have a bad day and rise. We're sometimes coy about dying, even in our baptismal liturgies, despite baptism being our tomb and our womb, as the early theologians put it. We tend to tone down the element of exorcism and renunciation, and we don't always use the oil of catechumens, which marks our rejection of the devil, evil, and sin. And we use only the oil of chrism very often, which is the oil of gladness. Does this suggest, I wonder, a liturgical desire to have life without passing through death? When her mother was slowly dying in hospital, it seemed to Karen Armstrong that death was taboo even there. When we go to hospital, we're meant to get better and meet government targets, she writes. We're not supposed to die there anymore. Like Alice, she says, we banish death from modern society, pushing it off stage in hospices and nursing homes. She's right that Western healthcare too often conveys a sense that death must be resisted, postponed, or avoided. But hospices try to remedy this problem. Hospice care extends into people's homes and involves an explicit philosophy that death is neither to be postponed nor hastened. Hospices are proactive in learning about dying, and they take educational programmes to schools and elsewhere. Christian understanding of dying well is now growing most extensively through hospice work. The concept of hospice has been evolving since the 11th century, the Common Era, when at the time of the Crusades, hospices were found as places of hospitality for the sick, wounded, or dying, as well as for travellers and pilgrims. An emphasis on hospitality remains central to the modern hospice movement, which owes most of its vision and impetus to Dame Cicely Saunders and her founding of St Christopher's Hospice in London in 1967. Saunders describes the hospice as, to quote, a place of meeting, physical and spiritual, doing and accepting, giving and receiving, all have to be brought together. The dying need the community, its help and fellowship. The community needs the dying to make it think of eternal issues and to make it listen. Listening is a hallmark of hospice life. Saunders tape recorded conversations with hundreds of patients at the end of their lives. And out of that, she developed the notion of total pain to convey the physical, emotional, social, and spiritual components of the pain that these patients experienced. Palliative care treats pain on all of these levels and aims at healing rather than a cure. A cure is the removal of disease. Healing is seen as possible even in death in a way that is wholly consonant with Christian hope, or the Christian hope of transformation. So as a writer on palliative care and ageing puts it, Christians believe that even in death there is healing. Healing can occur in the presence of the disease as the person grows into wholeness of body, mind, and spirit. Well, there are now more than 8,000 hospices and palliative care units around the world in over 100 countries. Saunders' Christian faith was a fundamental motivating factor in her care for the dying. At the same time, she was clear that a hospice is for people of all faiths and none, and that people's spiritual needs are not necessarily to be defined by religion. In hospice settings, speaking very generally, religion is understood in terms of a set of beliefs or the following of liturgical practice and use of ritual, and spirituality is understood as aiming towards an integrated inner life. Some people are religious and not spiritual, says a Christian hospice chaplain in the States. Some are spiritual and not religious, and some are both. He says, intellectual assent to a codified set of doctrines does not provide one with the spiritual resources needed to cope with the many challenges of life and death. And he adds that religion can be a double sword. For those who believe that if they keep praying they will get well and then do not, their faith can be shattered because it was not deeply grounded in the first place. I discussed these observations with a Marie Curie nurse who agreed but added that she observes that people who are religious often have a better death because they have more of a sense of where they are going, and in her case, which I'll return to, they have more being. It's interesting that she just sort of plucked that phrase from the air. Hospice care is person-centred. Patients define what they mean by a good death, and the care team help them to achieve it. Religious frameworks are not imposed upon patients who are not religious. Hospice chaplaincy teams are increasingly multi-faith, but chaplains recognise that they may not be asked to share the teachings and practices of their own faith. It's also the duty of the whole team, not only the chaplains, to offer spiritual care, but chaplains are called upon to provide particular expertise, such as conducting a ceremony, listening to a final confession, or creating a space for family and personal reconciliation. Palliative care teams recognise that unaddressed spiritual distress can lead to poorly controlled symptoms, an increased need for pain relief, and an unquiet death. So one of the many fruits of hospice work is the wealth of research into the nature of spiritual health, which helps to convey what it is like to be dying, what are the lowest points, and what brings healing. Hospice care teams gauge a patient's spiritual health by her ability to find meaning. They take the view that people can suffer almost anything if there is meaning attached to it. They also observe that when patients are able to tell stories about their lives or to express themselves creatively, this can reduce the need for pain, or sorry, the need for pain relief. And so for this reason, they place great value on art and music therapies, ethnography and film. I'm just going to show you the end of a clip of some filming in Strathclyde Hospice. It was a clip of some of the patients singing in hospice. Now, it's not always clear what meaning means in palliative research. The most fitting generic account that I've come across is that it is the ability to translate dying into the fulfilment of living, and so to find or assert oneself in the midst of disintegration. So the reason that Amy Hardy films people singing is because singing is one way of finding yourself, asserting yourself, making your mark. Telling stories is another way of doing this. Stories are a way of redrawing maps and finding new destinations, says Arthur Frank in his book The Wounded Storyteller, which is a seminal book on illness. Stories are also a way of summing up one's life, and so of finding it sometimes for the first time, or with sufficient completeness to then be able to let it go. Marie de Hennezel, a psychologist in a palliative care unit in Paris, described an encounter with Dominique, who cannot bear being pinned in bed waiting to die. Marie asks her if she has finished living or if anything is tethering her to life. Dominique replies that there are so many things still unsettled. Marie invites her to tell her about them, and she responds with her life story. She ends by saying, "So this is all me, this is my life." It's your life, Marie reiterates, with the emphasis on your. And Dominique then falls asleep with a smile of triumph on her face. Being heard, becoming engaged, being empowered seem to be the crucial things that help. Hence, Cicely Saunders' insight that those who are dying bring gifts which we receive through listening. And this fits with patients' own accounts of good spiritual care. Namely, good spiritual care is the practice of being listened to, which engages, to quote one patient, it engages their essential inner self rather than their weakening outer self. Reference to an inner self reminds me of the Marie Curie nurse's phrase that religious people seem to have more being. It echoes Pauline language and returns us to the pattern of ongoing transformation. We do not lose heart, wrote Paul in his second letter to the Corinthians. Though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed day by day. Paul looked forward to the completion of this transformation on the other side of death. Not everyone, and not all Christians, take a post-mortem view of being both. Some regard spiritual development when dying as pertinent only for the here and now, and for what can be passed on to others. Either way, an emphasis on the inner person is empowering when one's outer person is fading. And furthermore, people come to feel that the most important part of them is growing. In this way, they may feel accomplished in their dying. Death can cause a human being to become what he or she was called to become, wrote François Mitterrand. It can be, in the fullest sense of the word, an accomplishment. The virtues of participation and empowerment become confused where people have dementia, and also in debates over euthanasia and assisted suicide, where loss of autonomy is often the main point of concern. Euthanasia has been legalised in the Netherlands, Belgium and Luxembourg. Assisted suicide in Switzerland, and also that in the Netherlands, and in three states in the United States. In assisted suicide, the patient is the last causal actor. In euthanasia, the doctor or other agent is. An assisted suicide bill is currently out for consultation in Scotland. A previous bill for euthanasia was rejected in 2010. Since compassion is a paramount factor, Christian responses to assisted suicide proposals are divided. There is international research, however, showing that physicians who are religious are less likely to support assisted suicide, and that religious patients are less likely to request it. For Christians, there may be at least two strains of thought at work here, that life is sacred and is given and taken by God, and that we should not come into God's presence unsummoned, which is a Thomist argument against suicide. In Christian thinking, we participate in our dying by giving up our spirit. This maps our dying onto the pattern of Jesus' death. Jesus did not befriend death, but surrendered to it when his time came, waiting until the conditions were fully ripe for death to yield life. Correspondingly, chaplains or accompaniers help people to give up their spirit by helping them to resolve any concerns that are tethering them to life. Chaplains do not, like doctors, have a duty to preserve life, nor are they likely to struggle, as doctors often do, with views of death as a failure. They accept the irretrievable process of dying, and like midwives, help a person through this process when the right time comes. Now, these three attitudes to death are at play in these perspectives, which says much about the complexity of our deliberations. The language of surrender is coloured by Christian negotiations with death as friend or foe, and the way we move between those. But we keep these personifications of death out of medical and legal debate, where anyway the prolonged illness rather than death is seen as the greater enemy. More pertinent for public death is a third attitude to death, which is also available to Christians: death as a natural process. This natural attitude sits well with environmental emphases, and is expressed in the growing trend for woodland burials, and in Celtic Christianity, which emphasises our bodies being enfolded by the earth. A natural view is also present in the palliative care perspective of letting death run its course, and is apparent in some instances of hospice aftercare, for example in the case of a toddler being allowed to crawl over the body and coffin of her deceased mother. But a natural view is complex in end-of-life debates, because medical science has made these things possible. Our ability to prolong the most limited of lives obscures a sense of a natural end. In the meantime, where people's hopes for euthanasia or assisted suicide are dashed, they live out prolonged suffering. In this unhappy state of affairs, it's some relief to find statistics showing that increasing the quality of palliative care correlates with a decrease in numbers of people opting for euthanasia or assisted suicide in parts of the world where they are legal. Paradoxically, by surrendering to our circumstances, we take part in what is happening to us. There's Christian debate over whether illness is to be resisted or accepted, which parallels the ambiguity over death as enemy or friend. George Sheehan describes his experience of trying each approach when receiving treatment for cancer. Initially, he resisted his illness, just as Jacob had wrestled with God. Then he surrendered and found himself back in what he calls the Eden of his childhood. It is a land where 7 and 70 are kin, where there are no concerns other than playing and learning and loving. The inhabitants of this land are in no hurry. Our days are dense with experience. We have, as the Spanish say, more time than life. He's describing what's sometimes called intensive living, which is a medical, psychological, and social concept that contrasts with hectic living. The concept conveys how life can be transformed in the face of knowledge of death. You can't really be happy you're going to die, Alistair Campbell asked his friend Philip Gould. No, he replied, but these days and weeks have been amazing, maybe the most intense days and feelings of my life. It has made me feel whole. It has made me appreciate my life, my politics, my family, my friendships, more than I would if I had gone on and on and died of old age. The art of dying is full of the paradoxes of giving things up only to find we get them back in a new way. Our loved ones, time, our sense of our own bodies, our dignity, our very lives in terms of the intensity and insight in which we live them. I don't have time to say much about the ministry at the time of death or afterwards, but I will just briefly touch on how Christian ministers themselves practice the art of dying as they support and accompany others. I've shown ways in which Christian ministry has needed to adapt, for example, to funerals which are barely funerals and to spiritual care which is not religious. Healthcare chaplain Ewan Kelly describes creating a funeral with a bereaved family in which there is no mention of God, afterlife, or any other religious belief or affiliation, the kind of funeral that creates work for Bishop Jeffrey's committee. The funeral director asks Kelly, "Do you find it hard not to mention the Lord?" But Kelly believes that the Lord was implicitly a large part of the funeral because of the way that Kelly served the family in responding to their needs. He made himself vulnerable and let go of his professional tools, and so, he said, he embodied Christ's life and teaching. Bruce Rumbold, an Australian hospital chaplain, talks about running the risk not just of professional inadequacy, but of personal helplessness in order that change may come about. The proper balance, Kelly explains, is between vulnerability and appropriate use of authority. I will end with two stories from Christian accompanists who felt themselves die to their professional knowledge and training and plunge into feelings of helplessness, and in that dying found their Christian ministry return to them. The first is of a hospital chaplain who was asked to administer the last rites to a man who was gravely distressed but who could not speak. Not being able to hear his confession, the chaplain had to find another way. He asked the man to offer his distress to God so that God could transform it. The man became calm, and he and the nurses anointed him with oil. This occasion brought peace to the dying man, insight to the chaplain, and returned something to the nurses, their sense of vocation, as they developed ways of attending to patients bodily that went beyond the basic functions of applying drips and toileting. The final story is from Jenny Millard, a colleague of mine, who had a ministry among the many AIDS sufferers in Edinburgh in the 1980s and 90s. She would clean and shop for them and watch with them when they were dying. As she waited with them, she would jot down thoughts and things they had said that would help her to construct their funerals. She called these jottings fragments of the watch. Her former boss, the then Bishop of Edinburgh, Richard Holloway, has encouraged her to let him publish some of these fragments. One concerns a young woman who was very afraid of dying. "I don't want to die," she said. "Him upstairs will get a big stick and shout at me and tell me to go to hell. I'm frightened. I don't want to be shouted at." "And I hugged her," J.B. Lott wrote, "bereft of anything theological to say that sounded real. And she stumbled in. 'Talk to me,' she whimpered. 'There was a man who had two sons, and I told her the story of the prodigal son and the loving father. Will you be with me when I die? Be sure and tell me that story.' So I did, about an hour ago, and now we are waiting for the undertakers."